What's up, everyone? This is Dustin Hawkins, and welcome to episode 22 of the War Podcast. What's up, everybody? I'm excited for you all to experience today's show. Today, my guest is Troy Meyer. He is a guy who has been diagnosed with MS. He's a guy who's battled with serious meth addiction, and he has since transformed his life. He's now working in the recovery field up at Brighton Recovery, where he's helping people. He's got an awesome outlook on life and an amazing philosophy on what it takes to capture the abundant life and to live a life full of sobriety and happiness. Our discussion that takes place is amazing. We talk about family, we talk about friends, we talk about creating new hobbies and health, and so it's a pretty unreal conversation that I think you all will get a lot out of and will appreciate. And remember, tell others about our podcast, even those that are struggling with this disease, so that we might be able to keep spreading the word of what we're doing and help more people with the lifestyle that we are promoting. Enjoy the show.
So my first symptoms were in 2011. About October, my son had been born in September. My grandma had just passed away. And a couple weeks after my grandma had passed, I started having numbness from the waist down, and then completely was numb from the waist down. Couldn't feel anything in my legs, my toes. Went through multiple MRIs, test to see if I had slip disc or a herniated disc or something that might have been causing that.
Wow. And so you kind of thought it was related to like your addiction?
Absolutely. I had been clean for 4 years at that time. You know, heavy meth addiction for 4.5 years prior to that. 2008 is when I got clean, and then it was about 4 years of being clean. It just overnight, I thought, I was driving forklifts at the time, and I thought, maybe I just had poor circulation. That's why I was going numb, right? But then it hit me so quick. Within 4 days, I was, you know, it was 1 foot that was numb. And then within 4 days, I was numb from the waist down. And then 2 weeks, my left leg was basically non-existent. I barely could walk. You know, I was, my son, I remember we lived in a three-story apartment. We were on the top floor, of course. So I had to make that haul up and down right. The stairs all the time with that bum leg. And then you know, I couldn't even carry my son from the bedroom to the kitchen, you know what I mean? I had to have my wife, you know, essentially just carry him and bring him and set him in my lap, because I was afraid I would fall or something, you know what I mean? So it was a pretty drastic process, man. It was hard, you know what I mean? I was, let's see, at that time I was 30, so 30 years old, not knowing what's going on with me. Doctors didn't have an answer, you know. And
wow.
About 2 months in, we did a spinal tap and came back a positive for the, you know, that I was being diagnosed with MS. And so from there, I at least had some indication of what I was faced against, but I didn't know anything about MS. Wow. I didn't know. A good friend of mine's mom had MS, and she ended up committing suicide because of how intolerable it was for her. She couldn't deal with the pain. She couldn't deal with the, it can definitely emotionally tear you down. And she ended up taking her own life because of it. So my only recollection of what MS was I would be faced with this someday, right? So I instantly got on and, you know, my wife was a huge supporter. My dad was there the day I was diagnosed. My wife did some research and found me one of the best MS doctors in Utah. We started me on some steroids, prednisone and salumedrol, got on some MS medications and did that for about 2 years. And it my quality of life on those medications was pretty bad, man. It was made me sick, really sick, you know. And so about 2 years of medication, I quit taking medication. I haven't been on medication for about 4 years now. And
do they want you to be on medication or?
Yeah, I mean, yes, because it's a progressive disease, right? As is addiction. You know, the part of that is, you know, long term, it'll help. But my quality of life on it at that moment, and you know, I'm not saying that everybody should stop taking their medications for MS, but you know, it just for me, for the quality of life, you know, I was on it. It just didn't work for me in the point in time. My quality of life now is a lot more manageable than it was when I was on the medication. And so, it's just like the addiction, man, progressive. You know, I could, I actually have relapse remitting, MS, and so it can come and go as it chooses. And, you know, I think mind over matter is a huge part of my success there. You know, as you get to know me, like I look at the positive or try to look at the positive and everything, and I'm pretty happy and fun. And, you know, I try to just have that mentality and not let it get me down. But there are times where I am down in the ruts, you know, but I try to pull myself out when I acknowledge that. So
wow,
it's pretty intense.
So just popping in here, everybody listening, I'm here with Troy Meyer. He works up here at Brighton Recovery, this unbelievable program they have up here. I posted a couple things on Instagram, on my Instagram, showing the facility and the type of program they have. They have this residential here in Salt Lake, up in Cottonwood Heights, and then they actually have another residential program right there in South Ogden, right by my house.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting because right when I just started war, in 2010, I believe it was around that time is when Brighton was coming in and so moving into that neighborhood.
Right. We took our first patient in July of 2015. So we're working on 3 years there.
In Ogden?
In South Ogden, yeah.
Maybe it was they were going through all the city stuff,
yeah,
and trying to get it all going.
Right. Yeah. It was a process from what I understand. And, you know, we're pretty fortunate to have that facility and, be a part of that community and give back as you are. I mean, you're a headstone in that, you know, I mean, you're concrete in that community. And, you know, I mean, we're all there for the same reasons. Right.
Right.
So
help
pretty,
people.
Yeah, absolutely. Pretty fortunate to be able to help people up in the northern part of Utah.
What happened to you as far as with your addiction and now you're in this world of helping people get into treatment? And I want to hear a little bit about your story and what led you to the career path you're in now.
Yeah, man. You know, as a kid, you know, my dad, suffers, you know, he's heavy into the 12 steps and AA, you know, meetings. He suffers from alcoholism and drug addiction himself. My mom, you know, was a huge enabler. You know, and once my dad went to prison when I was 19, my mom was able to pretty much focus that attention back onto me. And I had a kid at 20 years old, and full, you know, I had partied through high school. Nothing really resonated with me other than using ecstasy at that, you know, at a younger age. But when I had my daughter, I was able to pull my head out and get clean, you know, and drank here and there socially. And then once I was introduced to meth, I mean, I remember the first time I used it, you know, and I had friends that would use, and it was funny because, you know, my perception of people that use meth were the homeless guy with no teeth underneath the bridge, right?
Right.
And I'm like, dude, why are you guys using this stuff? You know, it's nasty. Like, you guys are gross, you know? And I ended up being the worst one of them all, you know?
Right.
I mean, not really, but, I mean, I was deep, man, to the point where, you know, I stopped. I would get promotions and then get fired from jobs because I'd be up for, you know, days on end and then sleep for days on end. And then... you know, started stealing to support my habit. you know, to front the drug dealers their money, you know, whatever they needed, I was able to steal from whoever, and I didn't care. I mean, my morals. And what was crazy is when I wasn't high, I didn't have the awe to do it, man. You know, I was scared to steal. I was terrified, but as soon as I put that drug into my body, man, it didn't matter to me. I didn't care. Like, I needed to find my next fix, right? And, you know, I had some really good friends that went through that with me. And a lot of us have made it out, which has been amazing. You know, we have a couple that is still struggle, and we'll always have the light on and the door open for them. But, you know, as we know, this addiction can blurry that vision for them. And we've been fortunate to, you know, a lot of us all have families and kids now. We wouldn't have that. You know, one of my good friends, his brother was one of our dealers, and he's now, you know, he was served for 15 years in federal prison, you know, and so, and he has kids, you know, and it just sucks, man, to watch families destroyed by the disease of addiction. So, you know, for me, man, it was never really me until the day I got pulled over and I had 5 warrants out for my arrest. I had an empty bag on me. The cop, you know, searched me, found it, got me a possession charged, and about a month or so later, I was sentenced to Weber County Jail. Did 30 days there, was on probation with APMP for 2 years, and man, it was that a life-changing event, man. I was in jail for Thanksgiving, and I called my mom. She did a 3-way call with my daughter, and she was 6 at the time. And she's like, you know, Daddy, when are you going to come see me? And I told her I could. And man, what a, to be a couple weeks off of any mind-altering substances, right, man. And have to deal with that pain of years that I've caused. And she didn't know why. I had to face it right there in jail.
Right.
And, you know, panic attacks happen, high anxiety, you know, jail just wasn't the place for me, man. And then, that was on Thursday for Thanksgiving in 2008. And the following Sunday, there was a guy in there that was in there for the same thing. I was possession of meth. And, he called to talk to his wife, and his wife said, your son committed suicide last night. And that I watched this dude lose everything, right? And taking that emotion with my daughter that Thursday prior, and then having that guy go through hell, man, that's something changed in me that day, you know. And the December 10th, when I was released from Weber County, you know, that guy came into my cell and he's like, Troy, you got to get your shit together, man. You know, you got a little girl out there, and I just lost my only reason for living, you know. And unfortunately, that guy's loss was my gain, you know. And I worked hard, man. I did whatever AP&P told me, as much as I didn't want to do. I give that advice to any of our patients and anybody out there struggling, is, you know, when addiction, our addict mind can alter any type of thought process that we have. And for us to be able just to do what other people tell us to do through these programs, you just have to surrender. As much as you don't want to do it, it's the time that you should do it, you know. And I did that for 2 years, you know. I was babysat by the state. I was on a beach in Hawaii with my wife and my in-laws and my sister-in-law, Tyler, and my daughter, Alexia. And my wife was pregnant with Trace, my probation officer called me. Of course, I had to get a pass to leave the state, you know. But she called me, and she's like, Troy, I wanted to tell you you're officially terminated from probation with the state of Utah and APMP. And, man, what a place to be to get that information, man. And I was like, this is it, you know, and I made that change. And it wasn't easy, man. I mean, you know, coming up on 10 years this year of not using, man, is, you know, it's not easy, as we all know. You know, I mean, there are still times where you think about it, you know, there's a romantic part of that, but those thoughts go away 10 times quicker now than they ever did when you're first getting clean, you know. So through that addiction, man, you know, that was 2 years of being on probation. So then I was 2 years clean, had just had a son, 2012 or t- in October 2011, like I said, I started having those symptoms with MS, and I thought it was all drug related. I remember waking up that morning and like, man, I'm numb from the waist down. This is weird. And my wife and I went to the mall to buy my son some baby clothes. And I'm like, honey, there's something wrong. Like, I think I'm having like minor strokes or something. So I called my dad and he's like, well, let's get you to the hospital. And we did. They did some tests, and you know, like I said, it took about 2 months to get diagnosed, which was pretty quick in that field. But to sit there and not know what my life is going to be like, you know, and like, man, I'm 4 years clean now, and this is what I'm getting, you know, like this is the cards that I'm dealt now. And it was hard when I got diagnosed, but I immediately jumped in, man. I went to the MS Society. We do the MS walk. I haven't done it in the last couple of years, but you know, we raised our first year. We were one of the number one independent raising teams. It was called Team Fighter, you know, and it was exactly that, man. I fought addiction. I fought my way through life. You know, I have an amazing support system, which you don't see when you're in your addiction or even going through daily life. A lot of us take for granted what we have, you know, and so. You know, with the MS Society, that was great to give back to people that are less fortunate than I am, that have the disease a lot more progressive than I do. But I'm still, you know, one of them, just like, you know, some addicts are like, oh, I'm not like these other addicts. You know, we're all just on different levels. You know, some of ours is more progressive than others and some of them aren't. But you always got to check yourself at the door, man, because that's, you know, the moment that you don't. That's when it starts slipping through the cracks.
Right. Thanks for sharing that. So I want to hear about your life now. Like, so you said 10 years sober. Compare, and I want to try to do this to give people hope, you know, because that's a story of hope. And your life using... And then what's your mind frame like nowadays, like with in the sober life, like what's happened to your mind?
You know, I mean, there's still those battles, right, of maybe depression, anxiety, things like that. Constant. I mean, I think we're our own worst critics, so self-ridicule still happens. But I tell you what, man, my quality of life now to – be able to purchase my own home and support my family, be able to see through the eyes of the addicts that come through and understand what they're doing. My mind, my process, man, is very clear. You know, it allows me to have empathy, sympathy, love, compassion, you know, be able to actually process my emotions and allow them to happen, not push them away. So I was an angry kid, man. Like, you know, I mean, multiple, I was a rowdy one, you know,
right.
But anger fueled my daily life, man. And even when I start getting a little worked up, man, I start getting sick. Like I don't like to feel that way anymore. So I think I have the ability to calm that down, that beast inside. You know, a lot of people are like, I'm just an angry person, you know? I used to think that way too when I went through 5 anger management classes, but you know what I mean?
Right.
Like you can change that just like you can change anything. You just got to put your mind to it, you know? And as you and I were here talking about, you know, eating habits and working out and things like that, that I definitely, neglect, you know, I can put my mind to it. I just got to do it right. Just like everything else. So, as far as my focus, man, and, a huge thing that drives me is being able to work for Brighton. Like the opportunity that I've had here from day one, I've left everything else behind as far as, like other careers that I was trying to pursue, you know, and the opportunity here has just been amazing, you know, and I'm fortunate to be a part of this, affiliation, you know, be able to see the outlook of Brighton. And as you know us, you know, and we know you, it's pretty amazing to work with people in the community like War and you and give back to those people that are struggling, you know.
Right. Fight the war on addiction.
Absolutely, man.
I want to talk a little bit about the speed and amphetamines. So amphetamines were my thing. I mean, mine was, you know, Adderall. I got into Adderall pretty hard to play baseball on, you know, and that's where it started with me. And, and you know, where it's gone, you know, nowadays I think about these college kids and, what's going on in the college scene with these kids cramming for finals, you know, and using that amphetamine salt to try to get ahead and to try to make it so it's fun to study. I mean, I remember I was getting my MBA and my master's degree, and that's when the amphetamines got really out of hand. But I remember sitting down to write a paper, you know, like a big project, like a 30-page research paper. And I remember sitting down with my bottle of Adderall and knowing and being so excited to write the paper. I remember thinking, there's no other place I'd rather be than writing this paper. You know what I mean?
It's going to be the best paper ever written, man. Right? That's how an addict thinks, man.
But this is the problem with these amphetamines. I mean, you shouldn't, that's a dangerous thing. And, you know, and I'll be honest, my brain has, since having that experience of those years of going hard on amphetamines and then, you know, coming off them with opiates, it's my brain's changed, mm-hmm. you know? And I just think about these kids, man, these college kids, do they know what they're getting themselves into if they're taking high amounts of amphetamines, how hard that is on the brain.
Right.
You know, I mean, you've had experience with it that, and you see people all the time in recovery, it, you know, seems like you got out okay,
right.
But some people don't get out okay.
Right.
In their heads, yeah. And it's lasting, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, we see it every day, right? I mean, there's, amphetamine, it was the only thing that I was like, I mean, I used to tell people, you got to try this, man. This will change your life. Like, yeah. I would push it and, but not knowing the demon that sat behind it, right?
Yeah.
Man, what a huge mistake on my part, you know what right. I mean? But I remember that. I mean, I used to take Dexedrine for ADHD in junior high, man. My English teacher told my parents, I think Troy has ADHD. And they're like, well, why do you think that? And like, well, he shakes his legs so much he broke the weld on one of our chairs, you know? And right. they're like, well, we got to calm him down. And but then people knew what Dexedrine was, and it allowed me to sell that and make money through high school and not even know why.
What like, was the Dexedrine?
So it's like Adderall, okay. You know, just a kind
just
of
an amphetamine.
Focus. Yeah. Right. You know, and, man, I took it and I only took it for, I don't know, maybe 6 months or so before I just started selling all my scripts, you know, and, as a teenage kid, like then you have what people want,
right.
You know, and then you start getting that ability to be somebody, yeah. And you get a little bit of power at a young age. That's toxic, man. I mean, that's toxic anywhere. That's,
right.
That's what a lot of people get addicted to just in the field. It's not only the drug, but the power, the money,
yeah.
You know? And then when that's all gone, I remember getting clean. I'm like, I will never use again. That's, I don't think that's possible. Like I couldn't fathom it. And, but a big part of it was I want people to need me and want me, you know?
Yeah.
And if I don't have the drugs around, they're not going to want me or need me. But I tell you what, man, the fact that I get to go home every night to my beautiful wife and my kids and eat a meal and go to bed every night, dude, that's so rewarding. Not chasing that dragon, man. Like exhausting.
And they need you.
Oh yeah.
You know
oh,
what
yeah.
I mean? That's really all that matters.
Well, and we get to break the pattern for our culture, dude, for our children. Like, you know, like my parents did the best that they could on what they had. You
right.
know, my dad did the best that he could as an addict and an alcoholic. My mom did the best that she could, you know, that on how they were raised. Right. And I did the best that I could, you know, as a father at a young age. And, you know, I wasn't the best dad, you know, my ex, I wasn't the best. I mean, I was so bad for her. Like we were so toxic, you know, and, to be able to not be that person anymore and change, man, like Oh, dude, it's hard to imagine, especially when you're first getting clean or when you're using. Like, there's a part of you that is in a relationship with that substance, right? And you never want to let it go, you know. And finally, you find someone else to fill that void, right? You know, or something, whether it's working out or, you know, some, I don't know, there's a million different things that you could find that you connect with, you know. Mine's 100% family,
right? You know,
I need family in my life. I need that connection there, and connection's a huge part of recovery.
Huge.
So, right?
Yeah, the family thing, and it's the same thing. I share your same views. I mean, my family saved my life, and you know, the biggest thing that was hard on me is I always thought I was able to, you know, to be honest, my kids early on in my recovery were a trigger,
mm-hmm.
because my thought was like, I'm going home. I need something to be on my game,
right.
with these kids. You know, right. what I mean? And I need to take something to be on my game so that I'm happy and want, you know, but you know, and what I found is that they steal from you on the back end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you think that you're
dad,
you know,
of the world.
Dad of the world if the first 30 minutes, but then the second 30 minutes and so afterwards, you're irritable, and I'm thinking about ahead to how I can, you know, get more in me. Yeah, get more in me. So now, yeah, a 30 minute window, maybe I was great.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. It stole from me on the back end, right. And I was.
And realistically, those 30 minutes were great because you weren't your authentic self.
No,
right?
Like your eyes look funny.
Yeah,
your voice is raspy.
You're disconnected emotionally from your kids in that moment. As much as you think you're there,
right.
You're still not there, man. You're so numb, right?
No.
Even if it is, you know, I don't know. There's a part of the justification part of the brain, right? We justify everything. Like, this will make me be a better employee. This will make me be a better sports player. This will make me
right.
I mean, I was talking to you about, you know, us playing sober softball with Brighton, and by the way, Blake wants you to come play.
I know.
I'm putting you out there. I'm calling you out, man.
Keep talking about it.
Listen, I'll shed weight if you show up to sober softball.
That time I struck out in softball, bro. So it was.
I've struck out too, bro.
I can't get that out of my head.
I struck out too, but last Friday I hit two bombs and then switched up left-handed and hit a little dinger. You know, so it's just fun, man. I've struck out too, though. I swung right out of my shoes.
Yeah, but that was what happened to me. It was like the off season of, you know, me playing in the Astros organization, and I had a buddy who hit me up to play, and I was thinking, you know, yeah, I'll go hit a couple bombs, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
old man's game, right?
I'll be the guy on top, you know? And I went and I struck out, and then I think I missed a fly ball. Like, it was a shit show.
It's all right, dude.
Ever since then, man.
But when was the last time you touched a ball before that?
What do you mean?
Like, when was the last time you hit or caught or anything?
I just had barely gotten home from playing.
Softball's a different game, though, bro.
I mean, I can lean on that excuse, too.
Yeah. We'll justify it all day long, right? But where were we before that? What were we talking about?
Just talking about life and kids and softball.
Right. So, I don't know, man. I forgot where we were going.
Well, you know, going back to the family stuff, and going back to getting ahead with a substance, and this was something that was, you know,
I always wanted to
get ahead. Was I thought if I can get ahead, I can be my best self if I take this, and it's like it with the amphetamines, you know, I can write this paper or I can go into this meeting and kill it,
right?
And
everything.
We brought this up on the podcast before, but I just want our listeners to know how fake that type of thinking is. You can't.
Stinking thinking, right?
You know, you can't get ahead like that. I mean, some people can make it last. Like, you see professionals all the time and they want to say, but eventually
it'll come out, man.
It comes out, and you know, and wouldn't you agree that it just puts a bunch of holes in your character?
Oh yeah, man. You're not even close to who you are.
Right.
You know, I mean, I remember at the age of like 5 or 6, I'd stolen a couple of pocket knives from it was called Kaysville Drug down in Davis County. And my mom at the time was when there's an emergency, the dispatch. She worked for dispatch. Well, she was friends with one of the cops, right? So she called him down there and took me down there, dude. And from that day on, I was so terrified to steal anything, man. I mean, all through high school, everything. I never stole, even from my friends. I was terrified.
Right.
And but once I put meth in me, dude, it didn't matter. I was I was entitled to that stuff, right?
Right.
So absolutely, those holes in our character, those are stuff that I never did, man, when I wasn't using, you know. I mean, my dad puts it pretty much in a pretty clear perspective of, you know, he's essentially just allergic to drugs and alcohol. Because the moment that he puts it in, just like if you were to eat, you know, you're allergic to nuts and you eat nuts, you know, you have a reaction. And that happens. And it might not happen the first time you do it, but it eventually will happen, you know. And we are allergic to those substances, man. We have to be on top of our game and dissect everything that we put into our body and know what we can and can't do, where we can go. But our character completely gets demolished by substances, man. You know, and you can see it in people's eyes. You know, you know if someone's struggling with alcoholism. You know if someone's struggling with opiate abuse. I mean, they all have their own characteristics, you know, and that's the first place you see it is in someone's eyes, you know, and then, of course, the behaviors behind, right?
Yeah, and even the behaviors when they when they get the substance out of their system and they're starting to be in recovery, you know, then you can really see those holes in their character as well. I mean, every human has holes that they're trying to work on, you know what I'm saying? Or losing your patience or, you know, everything. If you're trying to better yourself, you're working on character,
right?
You know, but with addiction, like for me, I noticed, you know, that I'm behind in a lot of areas, you mm-hmm. know, where, you know, stuff that I think you only learn how to deal with. You only learn how to capture patience
mm-hmm.
and being a temperate and a humble and a meek person if you're dealing with the stresses of life sober.
Right.
You know, and it's like if I'm escaping that stress all the time by throwing something in the back of my throat or, you know, the monotony of life, you know, like for me, like, it's sometimes it's been hard to roll home
mm-hmm.
and know that I just got off work from 5 o'clock to 10. It's on, mm-hmm. you know, with the kids. I mean, being a father is a tough job.
Yeah, man.
You know, in this and learning a lot of that stuff for me, learning how to deal with all that mm-hmm. and go home and deal with the monotony of life.
Right.
Like that's been, and that's still something I got to work on, you right. know?
Well, and how easy would it be for us just to, you know, I mean, like I said, I love the amphetamines, man. How easy would it be for me just to go home with, you know, a pipe in my hand and go to the bathroom and then come out and knock out those 5 to 10 out, you know, 5 hours from 5 to 10 and, you know, portray that I'm something that I'm not. Cause, you know, I think that I'm dad of the world, but I'm really not because I'm still doing this on the side. Right. That's addict behavior, you know? And, yeah, man. I mean, I think a huge part of my, I mean, without a doubt, a huge part of my success is my wife, you right. know, man, what an opportunity to
how long meet. Have you, when did you meet her? Did you meet her in high school?
So no, the first place I actually met her was in a little crack apartment that I used to use in. She never used with us, but her friend used and she'd come over there and hang out. We never used in front of her. You know, but that was the first time I met her, and I was like, you know, I was back on MySpace. I tried to hit her up on MySpace, and she's like, dude, you're a poser, you're a loser, you know?
Right.
And I was still with my baby's mom, you know, her, you know, and she was my, you know, my ex was my foundation, basically, you know? Right. I didn't ever think I could rely on my mom or my dad, so I pushed them away, stuff like that, but I was active through my addiction. So I was using when I first met my wife, and then I didn't see her for a year or so, and I had went to jail and got clean and then met her right after that. Just started hanging out, being friends, and then, you know, eventually are where we are today, man.
Wow. You know? She's like your angel.
Oh, dude, like, it's insane, man. Like, you know, I give her a lot of credit, being able, there was something, she allowed me to be me, you know, which I don't think I had my whole life, you know. I feel like everybody was trying to mold me into what they wanted me to be, you know, whether it was through high school sports or that whole nine, you know, or relationships. And I don't know, there was just something that made me chase that dragon, you know, with her, because I wanted that freedom, you know, and I'd just gotten clean, you know, and, you know, we got married, and, you know, we have two kids together now, and like, holy crap, talk about someone that would hold you and make you accountable, you know, it made it worth it to me, you know?
Wow.
So
I say that all the time too. My wife's my angel, you know, like, and I tell her that, like, I could not live. I mean, I shouldn't say I couldn't live, but I mean, I need her. You know what I mean? Just probably like you need your wife. I'm thankful I got her, because she stuck, you know, I'm a weirdo. I'm a weird dude. I mean, as far as like, it's like,
so it's just a charity case for her, right?
Yeah. How, you know, up and down I've been over the years, and me dealing with the,
she loves you for who you are, man. Yeah, that doesn't matter to her. Yeah. And that's what I love about Lexi too. Like, you know, I'm not the perfect Jim, bro, but, you know, I'm not the best husband. I'm not the best father. You know, but I just try my best, dude. And at the end of the day, that's all you can do, you know, and I'm not, I have a lot of flaws still, you know, just because you get clean, you're not perfect, man. No. Like, you have so much, those character flaws, dude, or, you know, and they'll shine, you know, and, but you gotta be humble. You can't push them to the side, and your ego can't embrace them, you know, those moments as we see dudes leave our programs are like, I got this. Yeah. You know, you're like, slow your roll, buddy, you know, cause you never got it, dude. I could score anytime I wanted, you know, but as you get out in your environment, you know who you are, you start identifying that, and you find something else to focus on.
Right.
Mine was family, man. You know, I was able to focus on Lexi, and man, like, she's, dude, I mean, you've met her. She like, dude, she pushes me so hard, man. Like, it's never good enough for her. She's like, you know, when I first met her, I was doing bar in a security in a bar, driving forklifts. And she's like, this is who you want to make $10 an hour. Like, this is who you want to be. She's like, I don't want to be with that. You know, and I'm like, well, shit, she's going to leave me, right? So then, you know, I ended up working out at a detox, a psych hospital for 3.5 years. And I loved it. I loved being able to help people with mental illness. Watching that dynamic was very intriguing to me, man. And that's actually how I got into Brighton, man. I came across, you know, the clinical director of Brighton at the time, Joe, and then Cameron, who's our clinical director now, was doing an adolescent program. So I went and worked for Salt Lake Behavioral Health and did that. And then, you know, I love the people there. I love the patients, dude, you know, and, then I went and worked for Cameron, and then Brighton just did it open, man. And I'm like, this is it, man. This is what I'm meant to be. So when you're talking about our career in this field, dude, it's crazy to think about where I am today and how I got here. Cause if it wouldn't have been maybe for Lexi, dude, I'd probably be doing construction, or, you know, like being a mason, or, you know, hog tenant or something, dude, just putting my body through hell.
Right.
And, you know, even to this day, dude, my wife and I, just 2 nights ago, she's like, what do you think about just us going back to school and doing like one class at a time? I'm like, Alex, like, let's slow down, you know, like, it's never good enough. Like, she, dude, she's that type of person, man. She wants the best out of everybody, and she'll tell you that you're not doing a good job. You know, sometimes it's kind of a pain in the butt, but she just wants the best for everybody, dude. And she's, like I said, man, she's pushed me to be who I am today. She pulls out those character flaws, and she makes me identify them, and bam, dude, you know.
Wow.
But it's pretty amazing, dude.
Yeah, it sounds like you got a pretty special companion, you know.
For sure.
And that's the way I look at my wife too, man. I wouldn't be doing anything today if it wasn't for her, you know. So, but yeah, the thing about my life and where it's headed with my kids and family and with my addiction, and the thing that I'm really appreciating, starting to come to see, about the sober life is that the sober life is actually where the most high adventure takes place because of the monotony of it.
Right.
Like wherever we think people think it needs to be exciting all the time.
Right.
You know, like it's not. Right. I mean, life's full of work. It's full of spending time with family on Sundays, and it's just full of experiences that, you know, in my addict self, this is lame.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But now as you grow into sobriety, I'm like,
God. I like being lame, bro. I love it, dude. That's probably why I've gained 80 pounds.
Just,
you know,
just an ordinary life. And it's fine. It's, and it's actually where you, the most, you know, like a couple weeks ago, you go on a vacation.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit about that. You went to the Redwoods and I mean, but you know, that's high adventure, dude. You probably lived in the moment.
100%, man.
You can't capture that if you're using.
No.
You would never be doing that.
No. My grandpa, my dad's dad, lived in Brookings, Oregon. We'd go up there every summer, man. We'd go deep sea fishing here and there. I was allowed to take a friend with me every year. You know, we'd drive through the Redwoods. Like, it's a truck, you know. But, dude, it was one of my highlights of every summer, you know. And, my dad unfortunately didn't have the opportunity to be at his dad's funeral. But my mom and I drove up and I was actively using at the time, right? And my dad was too. Me and him, you know, I'm like, oh, you're a piece of shit. Like, you're using, when I was doing the exact same thing, right? I had to deflect my own crap onto my dad, right?
Right.
I had to make him the bad guy, which wasn't fair to him in our relationship. But he wasn't able to go, and he didn't want to face his family while he was strung out, stuff like that, which is completely understandable. But I still went, but I made my mom pull over at every rest stop so I'd go in and, you know, hit the pipe, man, because I had to use, you know what I mean? And I remember, actually, she was sleeping, and I was driving, and I started nodding off. We went to the median, man, and I almost overcorrected the car. You know, I was driving, but I had been up for a couple of days prior to that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, me and my mom could have lost our life that day, right? She woke up. I'm like, no, it's okay. Like, you know, I played it off or whatever. But I wasn't even able to cry at my grandpa's funeral, dude. I was so high. I was in his bathroom in his home that he'd worked so hard for his whole life. And he's dead, and I'm at his funeral, and we're all at the house, at his house, and I'm in his bathroom lighting it up, you know? And my mom and I didn't even get to enjoy that. I wasn't in the moment, right? And then two, you know, we're about 15 years later now from when my grandpa passed. You know, my dad and I and my wife and my dad's fiance and my Trayson and Oakley, we went on a road trip, man, to kind of relive that. My wife's never been, you know, and my kids, they were amazing. It was weird, you know, like a road trip like that. It's at least 16 to 18 hours to get there. You know, we broke it up over the days, but.
It's just you, your wife, and your kids.
Yeah, man. And then my dad and his fiance in another car, right?
Wow.
So to drive through that, man, and like not have cell service half the time, you know, like, dude, what a, like you have to improvise, right? That's what being in the moment is, man. We take that for granted every day, right? I mean, I'm a workaholic, man. Like I supplemented work with addiction, you know, and, you know, my boss, Josh, man, he's a huge, like, Troy, you gotta slow your roll, you know, like you're doing an amazing job, but you gotta take care of yourself and your family. Go enjoy it. You know, when I call him at 8 o'clock at night and he's like, what are you doing calling me, dude? You're not even at work. You know, like, it's just cause I have that in me. I have that drive and I want it, but to be able to be mindful going through those Redwoods, dude. And like seeing trees that are 1500 years old, 3000 years old that we have no idea what's out there, you know,
right.
And through addiction, dude, that's there's nothing else out there but yourself and that drug.
Yeah.
You know, you take for granted your family, your relationships, you know, the smell of the trees, like to be sitting here and like I can hear the birds chirping through our headphones right now. Like, it's what a cool, like, to see the scenic view and be here today in this moment. I wouldn't have if I wasn't doing what I'm doing, man.
Yeah.
So.
And dealing with it. I know I and when I was in my addiction, I was working up at Huntsman Cancer Institute, and I took this drive every day, and there would be no music. At the time, I didn't even put this together, okay? But then, so when I got sober and I took the drive and I was starting to get into recovery, I was like noticing beautiful parks. I was like, dude, I've taken this drive for 2 years.
Right.
And never noticed anything.
Right.
Never listened to, and now I'm back into music.
Right.
I'm like loving music again.
Right.
I'm like watching movies and good film. Like it's incredible that we would do a substance that makes us that miserable.
Right.
And you know, I say this about opiates all the time and any substance really, but no one liked me.
Right.
Like literally like, and when I see someone on opiates or, like they're just not likable.
Right.
And not that I won't love them.
Yeah.
But you're just not likable.
Right. Well, it's because, you know, our natural instinct, especially going through our addiction, is to push people away.
Right.
Right. We test those that love us. And then, the only people we really want to connect with are the people that'll supply us, and we utilize and manipulate them to the fullest, just like we do our family to get money or whatever. Right.
Right.
So of course we're not likable. You know,
right.
And then you have the stigma behind addiction. You know, you have like, there's stuff out there, man, that it drives me nuts to watch all these people put addicts into one category. You know, all addicts are the same. That's right. Not true, man. That is not like, we're all, you know, we're all dealing with our own issues and everybody's story is completely different. You know, the stigma behind addiction, you know, it blows my mind that people think that, you know, addicts are these murderers and rapists and, you know, just these evil people, you know. And you know what, those people have to be rehabilitated too, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like you know, I've had the opportunity to get to know a sex offender that lives in my neighborhood, you know, and he made a mistake when he was 19, you know what I mean? And like, people judge him for that, dude. And I straight up asked him right next door to me, man, you know, and like, hey, like, what happened? Like, tell me your story. Like, I want you to know that I'm aware of this, but I'm not judging you for it, right?
Right.
And, dude, we have to give everybody that opportunity, man. Like, if we put stigma in front of humanity, we're judgmental, we're hurting our communities. And I mean, dude, like, I get it. Like, you know, I wasn't a likable person, and, you know, a lot of my friends wouldn't even invite me over because they thought I was going to steal from them, right?
Right.
But like, that's okay, you know, 'cause I put myself in that situation. But all addicts aren't the same, man. You know, there are millions of people out there that, struggle with addiction that are high functioning addicts, you know, and they just got caught, you know, right. And now they have an opportunity to change their life. And dude, I mean, we see it, man, to watch that glow come back in someone's eyes, that gives me chills every time, man. Like, I'll never forget, some of our patients that have come through, and I've been able to see that, you know, not that revolving door, but see that clarity and love and hope, and watch a family connect, man. Watch a dad hug his kids and actually hug his kids, you yeah. know, dude, you can't, you couldn't pay me enough to do what I do, man. I mean, I would do this work. Well, don't take that lightly, Jonathan, right. But you know, you know, this is where I need to be, man, because I love every person that I talk to, man, you know. And I had the opportunity to just help a friend out the other day with one of his friends, you know. And what a cool opportunity just to be that kind of that vortex, you know. As we are, man, we take those phone calls, we take them serious, you know. Each phone call that comes in, man, that's a family or a individual struggling that doesn't know what to do when they're in crisis, and we have to take that very serious. And you know, Brighton does an amazing job of that, and we've worked with you, and we see that progress there too, man.
Yeah, man, it's, I know that after you transform your life, wouldn't you say you get bit by the charity bug? You know what you're talking about, like, that's what happened to me. Working up at Huntsman, I thought I was just going to be, you know, a hospital administrator. And then once I started getting sober and putting this together, and then I started seeing some stuff on Facebook of people ODing and friends. And then all of a sudden I thought, man, I could show people what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, like, right. It wasn't just, it was like, I want to help somebody.
Right.
You know, I want to help somebody to change. And that's what happened to me. And then you see somebody, there's no greater high.
Right.
For me, when I'm just watching somebody capture a new perspective on life and a new way of life, and they're like, you know what I mean? And yeah. That's what's happened to you. And that's why I know that it's my calling to be in this industry. I look at it, I really do. I mean, I'm a spiritual man, and I look at it like it's my calling, and
right.
This is where I need to be.
Absolutely, man. I mean, not everybody can do what we do.
Right.
This industry's hard. It has a lot of turnover rate. But the people that succeed are the ones that, first of all, take care of themselves,
right.
You know, emotionally, spiritually, physically. But you're an advocate of what hope looks like, right? People can get addicted right. to hope, you know, especially family members. And that's what kind of keeps them, you know, through that revolving door of chaos, you know, or you're basically loving your loved one to death. But for us to be that vortex or that portal for people to get clean, like, what an opportunity, man, you know. And people thank you all the time, right? Like, you get right. that call from that mom, like, thank you so much, they're doing so well. And I'm like, you don't have to thank me, you need to thank your son for making that decision, you know.
Like, well, yeah, it's like that other day, yourself. That other day when we were at lunch,
dude.
That was spiritual.
Oh, bro, you know? Like, what are the chances? So there's me, you know, Sherm from Cold Creek,
Danielle
from War, and then Davis Hospital. Man, we're all sitting at this lunch table, and our server was a former patient's mother, and she recognizes us, right, dude? Right. Like,
and we all had influence.
Each one of us
influenced the kid in some way.
Some way one of us had part of him going to treatment, dude. And like, she comes up and she tells us, you know,
tears in her eyes.
Oh, bro. Like, that's why we do what we do, man. Right there. 100%. I will strive for that adrenaline rush and that emotion to be vulnerable and cry in front of that mother and say, right. you're welcome, you know, and thank you, you know, right. for given us the chance to be that opportunity. I mean, you know, her son went through the detox that was sitting there with us at that table. Right. And then he came to us and did residential and then was going to go to War. Right. Remember?
And I actually had been in, I had actually spoken to that kid like 2 years ago. He came to do War and I did a big consultation. He was trying to get in, but then he wasn't ready.
Right.
So, I mean, I knew, that was wild. As we were sitting there that day, I didn't put together until later on how important that was.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, and he just wasn't ready at that time, and thank goodness he didn't pass, you know,
right.
pass away from this. But, dude, I mean, what are the chances there, man? I mean, and then his mom is our server, and she recognizes us, and she says something to us at lunch.
Yeah.
Like, dude, I mean, it blew us away, bro. Like,
yeah.
you know? All of us had, I mean, our hearts, there was nothing to talk about being in the moment, man. Nothing else mattered in the world at that moment than the thankfulness from that mother saying thank you for helping her son, you know.
Right.
Dude, I mean.
It's just such a spiritual disease, and that's what I love about it. Like, people believe in higher powers or not, energy or whatever way you want to. There's something.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that, you know, from my perspective and the spiritual experiences I've had in this world since getting into this industry and turning my life over into it, you know, and it becoming my life's work. I've just seen so many spiritual and had so many spiritual experiences that I can't deny. And a lot of them I wouldn't share because they're kind of private, but
right.
you know, it's, and that's what I also appreciate
mm-hmm.
about this disease and right. and being in this line of work is being able to be a part of spiritual experiences.
Right. I mean, look at those aha moments, man. Like, you know, if you're doing things for the right reasons out there, you know, I mean, unfortunately this industry has, you know, gotten some bad people in it, you right. know, taking advantage of some vulnerable people and families out there, really doing some hurt. But if you're doing things for the right reasons, man, talk about aha moments. Like, you know, I mean, the opportunity to come to work and have something happen, and then you sit back in your chair and you're like, how did that even happen? Like, that was manifested. That was something. That was a God thing, you know, a universe thing, whatever your perspective is on that. You don't get those when you're using, man. You don't get those when you're an angry individual and you just hate the world and have no accountability for your own actions. You don't have those.
No.
You know, when you're doing things for the right reasons and you're trying your hardest to be the best you every day, you'll have those aha moments. And whether that's something, a smile in your kid's eye and you're like, I remember seeing that, you know, like a picture of me looking like that or something, you know, like,
yeah,
like, wow, like you see yourself, in so many things, you know, and, to be able to have the opportunity to have those and actually identify, like, wow, look at that moment right there. You know, you're doing something right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Really thankful for, being a part of this and, but I'm glad we talked, bro. And I'm glad we came on. This has been a spiritual experience for me. And, you know, I say this a lot, but like this podcast, I think I get the most out of it.
Right.
You know, a lot of it's for other people, but just being able to have a cool conversation like this. And, you know, our whole mission for this podcast really is obviously to help families and people be able to listen to it. But even people who can't make it to treatment, you know, so like I'm on the phone a lot of times and you know,
yeah,
not everybody can get into treatment.
Yeah.
And so I use it as like a, hey man, I got this podcast I'm putting out, you know, and you know, someone hears a story like yours or a conversation like me and you just had.
Right.
And it might help them.
Absolutely. I mean, anybody, if they want it bad enough, it can happen, right? And treatment's a huge opportunity to start that process, right? I didn't have the opportunity to go to treatment, you know. 30 days in jail was my treatment, you know. But that was, I didn't get treatment, but I got something out of it, right?
Right.
And that was not a lot of people can have the opportunity to go to treatment. But that doesn't mean that they give up, you know. Yeah. That doesn't mean the family gives up. You know, we do a free family community, service every Sunday, you know, for any family struggling.
Yeah, where's that at?
So we have one in South Ogden at our IOP location and then one at our Salt Lake location too. The IOP location. So, you know, that's ran by both of our clinical directors and it's free to the community, you know, so any family members that are struggling with someone that's in their family with addiction, they can come and just be a part of that, you know, and, what an opportunity to give back something, right? I mean, I tell all the detoxes that we work with, even if they don't come to Brighton, like, you know, give the family this, you know, give them something, man, you know, just, it's not a revolving door. These are human beings coming through, right? You know, and we need to give them every chance to get anything, any opportunity that they can, you know, and, you know, some people are like, well, we don't want to hold their hands. Well, you know what? Sometimes there needs to be some hand holding, you know, you got to lead the horse to the water sometimes, you know. Yeah. What I mean? And that's just what we are. You know, I mean, our culture here at Brighton, man, I mean, we see it start to finish, man. We have that phone call. We get them, we set up detox. We get them to detox. I mean, we visit them every day while they're in detox and then we get them to treatment, man. You know, I mean, you gotta be that, you know, you gotta be, just that opportunity, because people, as we know, you know, you just give them a phone number to call, they're not just going to call. Right. You know, I mean, how many times was I had opportunities to get clean, you know, but I didn't take them because I either wasn't ready or I was scared or whatever, you know.
You need someone to love you, you know. Oh, like, yeah. I've said this, but I'm here. So you're talking about, you know, someone in detox, you showing up. You're just showing them that you love them.
Yeah.
You don't even know them, but there's some love there. You're like, dude, I really actually give a shit.
Yeah.
You know, and if
well, because we've been there.
Yeah.
You know, like meth, you don't really detox from it. You just sleep and eat and you're ornery as hell and tired, right? But there's so much loneliness when that drug's gone, right? And if you're in detox, man, your family's not there with you, you know, you're there with in an environment that you probably don't like to be in, you know what I mean? It's hard, man. You feel so alone, and someone just showing up that doesn't even work there and doesn't belong there, that means a lot, man. And you know, a lot of us in this industry, we all have struggled with addiction ourselves, so we know what it feels like to be there, you know what I mean? I remember the first time my mom came to visit me in jail, dude, it was like the best thing ever, because it was someone different from the outside, you know. Right. It was, I got to see her through glass, but her and one of my buddies, Carson, was the only ones that came to see me in that 30 days, which, you know, none of my dealers came to see me because they didn't love me.
Yeah.
You know, so we need that, man. We need that love and support. Excuse me, that love and support, you know, because it's, we don't accept it. You know, we know that people love us, but we don't feel it. We don't see it. And as we start to get out of that, that chaos, man, we start to grow.
Yeah. I love, you know, and that's, I've seen, that's a big one of, as I've noticed over the years, is just loving and caring for people. So I love what you're doing. We'll both keep at it, keep helping people. Appreciate you being on. How can people get a hold of you? If people need to get into treatment, can they call you? Brighton Recovery? How do you want to?
Yeah. So Brighton, we have an on-call staff. We don't have, you know, that call center that you call and you get some call center. We actually have four of our admissions staff that will answer 24/7. You know, so you just dial 844-479-7035, you know, and go to the admissions line and you can start the process. If you have any questions about Brighton, we also have our link, brightonrecoverycenter.com. We have some amazing things there. We have our virtual tours of both of our residential centers. You can look at our clinical team and their profiles. You know, we have one thing that we just implemented is really cool. Questions that you should ask other treatment centers, you know, where do you stand on this? You know, what are your ethical beliefs here? And Brighton has also filled out their answers on that questionnaire. So you can compare and contrast to other treatment centers, making sure you're making the right decision for you. You know, Brighton's given that opportunity and it's, you know, you can download that off of our website. You know, it's good to ask a bunch of questions. Wow. To different treatment centers, you know, and make sure it's the right fit for you, you know, cause, you know, Brighton's not the right fit for everybody. Right. You know, and War might not be and whatever, right. As we see. So it's good. Like do your research, you know, choose three places, you know, do your research, and ask those questions. Don't be afraid to. And if someone starts barking at you, you know, it's probably not a good fit for you. You know what I mean? Cause they don't understand. So, you know,
yeah, I can tell you that this place is pretty unreal. Troy's become a great friend of mine. Unbelievable program. I'm going to post some pictures and stuff of, I posted a video on my Instagram and Facebook, and then I'm going to post some pictures, more of this campus here in Salt Lake up in Cottonwood Heights. And, the last thing I just want to say is, you know, some of the free treatment out there as well as you can go to meetings.
Right.
You know, I mean, people can, if there's a community at meetings, you know, there's a way to connect. They're free. You can go and hear other people who've got a handle on it. I mean, you get some unbelievable advice. So if you're struggling with addiction or you know someone, there's meetings. But you got to be willing.
Right.
You know, you got to be willing to go and leave your hard self behind and go there and realize that you don't know.
Right. Because you might have one of those spiritual aha moments, right?
Right.
At a meeting, man. I mean, those meetings can be powerful, and it's what you take out of them, you know. The moment that people start saying, well, this doesn't work, well, what are you putting into it to make it work?
Right.
You know, and there's always... There can always be accountability on your end to make something work, right? What could I have done better? You know, what could I have changed? What, you know, maybe this meeting didn't work for me, but another one will. you know, we can't, black and white thinking.
That's a good, that's bringing up a good point. If you go to one meeting and you didn't like it, like try other meetings.
Absolutely.
Cause you got to find a home group. You got to find a group that you can lean on and
connect with,
you know, and they're out there. I'm telling you, there was my home group that I got into on Sunday night saved me, you know, but it took me a minute, to figure out where I wanted to go with it. So don't give up looking.
Yeah. And the moment that you don't want to is the moment that you should, right?
Yeah.
The moment you don't want to go to the gym workout, the moment you should, you know, the moment you want to, you know, skip out on an AA meeting is the moment you should go, you know, and, it works if you work it, right? As they say. And, so does treatment, you know.
Right.
Treatment's not going to work if you don't work it. We're just giving you the tools. You know, you got to come in, you got to guns blazing, man, all in. And it's all accountability on yourself, right? What could I have done better to make this opportunity successful, right? So a lot of people want to, you know, turn that around and say, oh, well, war wasn't it for me. You know, they just, you know, we have that Brighton. Brighton just wasn't for me, you know. Well, it might not have been, but where's your part? Like, what can we, you know, where can we meet on that level, you know? Because that was me, dude. I used to, everybody else was wrong, not me, but there's a common denominator, and that was me. That was my thinking, right? Which was completely wrong.
Right.
Still happens a lot, but that's okay, you know. At least I acknowledge it.
Well, thanks for being on, man. No problem,
brother. Love you too,
man. Yeah, I'm glad you came on. It was a big deal. So, all right, everybody, we'll be back next week with more. Thanks.
All right, thanks, guys.